So, remember those cranberry-colored pants you wore in college? The ones you would not be caught dead in today? Polyester aside, is it the color that makes them so repulsive now? Why do some colors get splashed all over clothing for a few years, only to retreat for a decade or two, then reemerge as the greatest new thing? That's a question we'll explore in depth in this hour. You've heard of the Pantone system for managing color. Today we'll talk about the book Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design by Leatrice Eisman and E.P. Cutler. Leatrice Eisman is a color specialist and forecaster for Pantone. The company is the executive director of the Pantone Color Institute and heads the Eisman Center for Color Information and Training. Co-author E.P. Cutler is a fashion historian. It's Leatrice Eisman we get a chance to talk to today. Lee, welcome to The Exchange.
I'm happy to be here.
I bet a lot of people would like your job. How does someone get to be an international color guru?
Well, it took a lot of work to get there, but I've always been interested in color, and those people who really, really have a passion for color understand that it just doesn't pop up, you know, when you're 18, you decide, ooh, I'm going to be a colorist. It's something that really starts in your childhood. It's a tremendous interest in color, and it never abides.
So walk us into this slowly. I mean, we've all heard of the Pantone matching system, but what exactly is Pantone?
Well, it is the international language, if you will, of color. You know, graphic designers often understand what it is, fashion designers. People in the design field know it because it is a way of specifying color so that if you were on the phone discussing color, you had no way to send it to somebody 3,000 miles away from you, they could look at their Pantone book, you have one, and you could see, oh, yes, I see, Pantone Romantic Red number 123456 is the same color that I'm looking at. So it identifies color for people.
Does Pantone create colors or patent or copyright them or both or neither?
Well, it's a little bit of all of the above. There are colors that are done for specific companies who want to develop a color that is specifically their color, so Pantone can help them do that. But there is also a repository of Pantone colors where they've already been named in the Pantone system, and the system is meant primarily for fashion and home. And so you could go to that and specify a color and take it to a printer, and they would then interpret it into another Pantone color, and you would know that you'd have a match.
How many colors are there altogether known in the Pantone system so far?
Well, in the system that I work with most of the time, the fashion and home system, there are more than 2,000 colors. But there are various Pantone systems. There's a plastic system, and there's a system that the printing industry and graphic designers use. That's yet another system with many more thousands of colors. So we're talking about several thousand colors.
Well, would, for example, the fashion and home system and the graphic system have essentially the same colors by different names?
Well, the graphic system does not have names. That's only numbered. Well, there are a few of them that do have a name, like reflex, you know, reflex color and so on. But for the most part, they're numbered. And the people that would handle the colors, like, you know, if you were a fashion designer and then you wanted that particular color that you were using to be used by the print industry, then that would be converted into the other Pantone system. So there's a very close relationship between the two.
I'm curious about the transmission, though, from you know, identifying what a color is in the fashion system to making sure that the dyes for the clothing are accurately reflecting of what the color is in the Pantone system.
Well, actually, there are textiles that are dyed within the Pantone system I'm referring to, the fashion and home system, so that if you were working with a textile, then you could see more readily how that textile is going to translate into textile. But it also comes in paper as well for quick identification. So Pantone pretty much has the world of color covered.
It just sounds really hard to make sure that things come out exactly right, though, because it wouldn't take much variety, even between fabrics, I'm thinking, in the textile business, to make a subtle difference in the color that makes it not quite exactly what you planned for.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's called metamerism. Sometimes we look at color and we think it's one shade. We look at it in another, you know, we look at a catalog, then we look at the real color and we say, well, that's not exactly right on. And that can happen. That's one of the vagaries of color. But I think Pantone has honed that down to about as scientific as you can get to getting as close a match as possible.
There's a really good history to start the book. Where did we originally get pigments before we developed the synthetic ones?
Well, it usually came from some resource found in nature. You know, the best known is the fact that you could, squeeze little insects and out of it would drop red or purple or whatever dye color. And that is what people used to dye fabric or to dye anything that they were interested in recoloring. Of course, over the years, technology has taken over. And even though we are still using a lot of natural dyes, particularly in the last 25 years, there's been an interest in returning to natural dye stuff. Still in all, most of it is produced through technology.
Wow, and I think about some of the examples given in the book of, for example, getting an ounce of purpura took hundreds of thousands of mollusks. So
yes.
It can be fairly labor-intensive and certainly probably a little tough on nature at times.
Absolutely, and the one that you choose as an example is my favorite one because people wonder why the color purple was associated with royalty and the wealthy. And, of course, it's because at the beginning of using purple as a dye, only the wealthy could afford to buy anything that came from thousands and thousands of little squeezed mollusks.
I wondered. It makes perfect sense why purple would have been limited to just the people who are fabulously wealthy. Much more to talk about with Leatrice Eisman. The book is Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design. A reminder here, too, that this is our fall fund drive on Jefferson Public Radio. Second to last day. Tomorrow it all ends. Whether we make the goal or not, please help us make the goal of $190,000 with your pledge of support to 888-552-6191, 888-552-6191, or online at ijpr.org. Back with Leatrice and Pantone on Fashion in 1-5. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Leatrice Eisman, a color expert from Pantone. She's the executive director of the Pantone Color Institute and heads the Eisman Center for Color Information and Training. So she knows color. We're talking about the book Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design. Leatrice is the co-author with color historian E.P. Cutler. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about color in history, color in fashion, and color in the history of fashion. Join us at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Leatrice, this is one of actually several books that come from Pantone. Pantone on Fashion is a bit of a broad history. Give us the basic outline, if you would.
Well, we wanted to give an overview of fashion and color in approximately the last 100 years. And, you know, there is this huge fascination with color. I can engage people in conversation anywhere. I travel a lot doing presentations, and on the plane, the minute I say, you know, I tell them what I do, the first question out of a person's mouth is, oh, my favorite color is, you know, blue or green or whatever it is. What does that say about me? What does that mean? So I'm always, analyzing people as far as their colors are concerned. But it really has more seriousness in nature, and it's a fascinating subject. It's one that does demand a lot of homework. It is not the kind of thing where, for example, when we choose the color of the year, do we throw darts at Pantone chips that are placed in the office, and wherever they land, that's the color of the year. There's a lot of work that goes into developing all of this. And so we wanted to put that into a book to at least capture a great deal of the information, particularly pertinent to the subject of fashion.
So it's interesting to look at this book. I mean, it is lavishly illustrated, too. Again, Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design. It could not help but be highly colorful. It seems like we're talking about designs in clothing and colors, and they seem to push each other through the history of fashion, certainly through the 20th and early 21st centuries.
Yes, they do. And many times it color reflects what is going on in a particular era or time period. I can more recently point to the color green and how much more interest there has been in green as a color, and people even acknowledging that they actually like the chartreuse yellow greens, whereas, 30 years ago, that would have been difficult to get somebody to even admit they liked a strong yellow green. And that's because of the whole issue of environmentalism, people being more aware of the world around them, wanting to preserve the world around them. So green becomes a symbolic color. It goes beyond just the fact that I like the color, I dislike the color. It's a color that is attached to a social movement that has a particular interest to many people.
So it ends up in fashion because people are interested in the color? I'm trying to figure out which is the puller and the pusher here.
Well, it can be. It can go either way, but often it is because socioeconomically, there's something that comes to everyone's attention, as in the green that I just cited, and so designers hop on board and realize, well, what is the symbolic color of nature? Maybe we should be using more green, and so one feeds the other.
Are there times when a designer will just say, you know what, I'm tired of everything else I'm seeing. I want to do my designs in this color this year, and boom, out comes something that people haven't really seen in a while?
Well, yeah. I mean, the best example I can give you, since I was talking about the greens in particular, is the designer Norma Kamali in the 80s. I can remember her being very adventurous in bringing forth a yellow-green that was very bright. And I remember seeing it in the stores and thinking, wow, she's really pushing the envelope with this one. Because in the 80s, we were still kind of overcoming that avocado green thing that, you know, everybody was kind of OD'd on avocado, and they didn't want to see any more green. So she was pushing it. But interestingly, the color did not become big at that particular time, but she earned a lot of press and a lot of attention because she was adventurous enough to do that. So it's sort of like, you know, saying the cars are all going to be purple next year. You pick up the newspaper and you read that little blurb and you go into the showroom. Well, maybe I need to look at a purple car. You actually wind up buying a pewter car yet again. But the point is, the purple car is what drew your eye to the website or into the showroom.
I'm glad you brought up cars, because I've often wondered about that. I know the book is about fashion that you wear, not fashion that you drive, but it seems like car colors certainly have gotten a bit more adventuresome in recent years, because it always occurred to me, it was like, oh, that's right. The reason there are so many muted tones is because they're least objectionable. People will buy them right off the lot, as opposed to, like, wanting to special order a marigold orange Volkswagen or something.
Yes, that's true. And something else we have to think about as far as cars are concerned is that, as I mentioned, it can be a loss leader. I mean, it is something that will attract your eye when you read that something new is happening in cars and you get wind up buying the same thing again.
The pewter car.
But it drew your attention. That's the name of the game.
Let's drop back a little further then from just the color concept. We're talking to Leatrice Eisman about her book Pantone on Fashion, co-written with E.P. Cutler. The concept of fashion for the general public is sort of a 20th century concept, isn't it? It seems like before that there was not much of a fashion in that sense that you had to get the newest thing to wear.
Well, it was very much based on economic stature. Those who had a great deal of money, certainly color and design was very, very important, and they spent inordinate amount of money buying clothes and getting just the right color that was very fashionable amongst their fashionable friends. But again, it's technology that brought the difference about. And when dyes were then able to be done, we'll get back to the purple again, when it was discovered quite accidentally in a lab that you could make purple dye very inexpensively, it then became a color that the middle class could afford to buy. So much of it is because of affordability as to whether the color is appropriate or even available.
As you already mentioned, it's not like you choose the color of the year, and we'll get to that a little later on by throwing darts at a series of Pantone chips. You also point out in the book there is no secret cabal that decides the colors that all of us wear.
Right. So. No, that's true. And I think that people do think that those of us that are involved in it, you know, sit around and have these secret calls. And it just doesn't happen that way. It's that designers are often on the same wavelength. And, they travel to mills and they look at fabrics and they see what's being done. And I'm going to use that word technology again. Sometimes there's a new technology, whether it be in the color or in the fabrication, that catches their eye. And they all look at various adaptations of that, and that's the direction they want to go in. So nobody calls anybody else, you know, or speed dials them to make sure they're using the same color. They're all very competitive, as a matter of fact.
It's not like calling each other before the party to make sure you don't wear the same dress or something.
Exactly.
I'm curious, though, about that part you just mentioned, though, where the designers will go to the mills to check out the fabric that's coming. So the actual textile makers are driving some of this, too. So what will guide their decisions in when to put out a fabric of a certain color?
Well, you are talking about forecasts now, and
I happen to be a
forecaster, and many of the mills, the designers, the dyers, you know, anybody that's involved in the business of fashion will most often use a forecast. Forecasts are done by certain people, like Pantone does two forecasts, one in interiors and then another, the View Color Planner, which is used more broadly in the fashion area as well as other industries. So if you really wanted to have a leg up, you would look to the experts who do the forecasting, and they all have contacts. They know what's going on in the world of color. They also check history. They see where colors have been before. Is it time for a color to come back again? Is it time to redo combinations? Their recommendations are made in the forecast, and many of the people involved in the business of fashion and color will use those forecasts.
So the mill will look at the forecast and figure out, okay, marigold or dusty rose is going to be the color this year, so we're going to make a lot of dusty rose fabric.
That's part of it, but then again, the mills have their own staff that may have their own ideas. So, again, it's not a secret collusion of a group of people. It can be either or. The mill may have a staff that does their own forecasting based on their particular product, or they may refer to a forecast that has been done by someone outside the company. In most cases, you will find that they will use a forecast that not only comes from their own talented people within, but they'll look without, too, to make sure that they're looking at the broader picture.
It sounds almost like a stock market of color, but instead of trying to figure out the futures of certain stocks or commodities on a commodity exchange, you're figuring out what colors are going to be desirable in the near future.
Exactly. And you also know who your customer is. You have a feeling for what you think your customer is going to like. You also know that color brings a newness into people's awareness, into consumer awareness. And that's important, too, because, you know, if we all wore the same colors day after day after day, never changed a color, never bought a new tie or a new pair of socks or sneakers, then we wouldn't need anything like a color forecast. But the human eye is notoriously fickle. And if you put something out there that's just a little different than what you've seen before, you, again, may wind up buying what you bought before, but at the same time, you may just be induced into buying something that's new. And that's what the marketplace is all about.
Leatrice Eisman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a color expert and forecaster. She is the co-author of Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about color and color in fashion specifically. Phone number here, 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So given the role you find yourself in life and the numbers of people who come up and tell you automatically what their favorite colors are, can you, in your position, Leatrice, like or dislike a color?
No, I can't. Not from a professional standpoint. From a personal standpoint, I can. But this is something I tell my students all the time. You really, really have to forget about the personal when you are involved in making color choices, because other people have different feelings, different memories, recollections, likes, dislikes, and you have to keep your mind open to the possibility of every color that exists out there in the rainbow. Whenever I hear someone saying, you know, oh, I hate that color, I can't stand that color, I think, you know, that's a person who would not make a good professional using color, because you can't say that. You have to be objective.
But are there colors, for example, you'd happily surround yourself with and others that make you verge on upchucking?
No, none of those do. I never have that feeling. Truly, honestly, there is something to be said about every color. It's not just the color standing alone, but it's also the way you combine it with other colors, which is most often how you use color.
You know, when I think about designers in particular and how they work, it makes me realize a couple of things, one of which is how often we use colors to describe things just in general everyday language. For example, like in trying to compose the question, would a designer come up with an idea for using a color that nobody else was currently using out of the blue, of course, is where the expression then goes.
Right.
But does that happen? I mean, will a designer just say, forget it, you know, I'm just wiping everything clear. Here's where I want to go this year.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I think that the bigger the designer, the more successful they are, the more apt they are to push the envelope because they have a following. And many times if you have a following, you know, people can be rather slavish in their dedication to a particular designer or look. And they will take a look at a color and say, well, you know, if Ralph Lauren chose it, I guess it's got to be a pretty good color. I think I'll reach out and embrace that. But it depends. It depends on how safe you want to be, and some designers, particularly when, you know, the economy is kind of dicey, will want to play it safer and perhaps not reach out with something that's new and different. But again, I think that's a mistake because that's the driver that often brings people into the marketplace, into the store to buy something. They saw something online, they saw it in a catalog or a magazine, and they thought, gee, that, you know, I never thought about using that color with a purple or green or a red. Maybe I need to try that. And that's what makes the sale.
Can you still be surprised yourself after all this time doing what you're doing by the way people use colors together or the colors that are applied to certain bits of clothing?
Absolutely. I'm constantly surprised. That's one of the great things about being involved with color. It's always a challenge. There's always something new for the eye to look at, to embrace, to question. That's part of what color's about.
Leatrice Eisman, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book, Pantone on Fashion, co-written with E.P. Cutler. Let's talk about the subtleties now. How many people will notice the difference between, for example, on adjoining pages in the book, we have Cyber Yellow and Super Lemon. Mm-hmm. And how many people can actually detect the differences between those?
I think there are more people than you think would be able to detect the differences. I think that, you know, it's a question of taking the time and really studying it. I think there's so much about color that people take for granted and don't study. But if you do study color, one of the things that you're taught is to look at undertone, look at the various differences that happen in color. And it's fascinating. You know, if you walk into a store and you look at a group of garments hanging on a rack, and you know, you go in thinking, well, maybe I need something in the yellow family. And you start to look at the variations of yellow, it will start to pop out at you. You'll take them out, you'll look at them, and you'll say, okay, this has got a little more green. I don't know that I like that one as much as I like this gold over here, which has a little bit of a warmer undertone. They may not express it in so many words, and yet visually they will often choose what is pleasing to them or think, you know, they think it will match something else that they have. So, again, to answer your question, I think that we can see many more undertones than we give ourselves credit for.
We have a call here on the line. Let's go to Helga in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Leatrice Eisman.
Hi. Speaking of undertones, I used to dye my own yarn, and I recognize a lot of tones. I have heard that Mattel has a patent or copyright on its particular shade of pink. Is that true?
The Barbie pink?
Barbie pink?
Mm-hmm. All right,
well, you know, I can't comment on what they might have copyrighted. That would be something I would research. But I don't like to comment unless I know for sure. But it is possible, yes, to obtain a copyright in a particular area. If you make a particular product, everybody knows it, it's recognizable, then you can actually do that. But I'm not sure exactly of what Mattel's involvement is in that.
I think Helga's right about that, though, because honestly, the first digital camera we bought at our house was the Barbie camera, and there came the little thing that said Barbie pink is a copyright. Or a
mm-hmm.
trademark of the Mattel company.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting that you can own a color, so nobody else can create it or reproduce it without your permission.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, that you can actually own a color in the sense of nobody else can make it or.
Well, again, it's a matter of context. Where are you using it? How are you using it? Uh-huh. Rather than just a universal, nobody else can use this color.
All right. Just mechanically, what makes a difference, for example, between, say, poppy red and crimson, Lee? I mean, what kinds of things make the difference in pigments there?
Well, again, it's a question of undertone. I think when we're discussing it so that people can understand it, it's a matter of often of cool and or warm. When colors veer to the warm side, they will have more of a yellow or a golden base to them. When they veer to the cool side, they will have more of a blue base. And so if you explain it at that level and you ask people, you know, if a woman's going into the store and she's buying a lipstick, she's looking for a lipstick shade, and the person behind the counter says, this is a bit warmer, this would look good on you, it has warm undertones, you have warm undertones in your skin, I suggest this, then you can readily see when you compare the two lipsticks that one indeed does have a bluer tone and the other has a more golden tone. So that is what we look for first. That's the most simplistic but the easiest way to start to determine it.
It certainly helps us understand. I appreciate that. The book is called Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design. Leatrice Eisman co-wrote it with E.P. Cutler. And we'll come back and talk more with her on the Jefferson Exchange. But in the next 30 seconds, I get to remind you, it is Fall Fund Drive 2014. We're seeking your pledge of support. Programs like this stay on the air because the people who listen also contribute financially to make sure that we can continue to provide these programs. Please make your pledge of support on this second to last day of the fund drive, 888-552-6191, 888-552-6191, or online at ijpr.org. Back on the program in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about color. We're talking with Leatrice Eisman, who is with Pantone and the Pantone Color Institute and the Eisman Center for Color Information. As you might have guessed by now, she is a color expert and the co-author of the book Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design, co-written with color historian E.P. Cutler. It's a brilliant book that shows us everything from poppy red to lavender fog and just about everything in between as well, and how colors come into and out of fashion in actual clothing fashion over the years. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions or comments about color or color and fashion at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. You can also email us at jx@jeffnet.org. Lee, I'm going to guess at this point that you've been at color for so long that you can probably look at a swatch of color and say the Pantone number.
Well, yeah, sometimes it's a bit of a challenge in that some of the colors are very close to each other, but when there are more than 2,000, you know, it's hard to remember all of them. But, yeah, the more you work with it, the more your memory embraces the undertones and the color itself.
Okay, but you never chew out coworkers for wearing like 16-1496 to work that day?
No, I don't.
Good to know. It is really interesting to read in the book about how certain colors, I mean, really necessity is the mother of invention, but also the mother of certain colors being introduced, like Hermès, the French company, coming out with orange, a certain orange that it is made famous over the years. But that was simply because war conditions prevented other pigments from being available. Was that it?
Yes, that's true. And sometimes it does come from that. I mean, when Chanel made her brilliant discovery, if you will, of beige back in the 20s, it was, you know, people thought in subsequent years, wasn't that brilliant of her to create that Chanel beige in addition to her black? But she actually used the beige because there was a lot of war surplus that was available in that color. And so it became one of Chanel's best-known colors. So often it's financial circumstances that leads them down that path.
And as you flip through the book, you see colors that you remember wearing back years ago, and you think, "Well, yeah, why did that go out of fashion?" For example, rust. I remember you used to have some great rust-colored stuff, and I thought, "Well, they don't see that anymore." Is there a prescribed resting period for some colors? I mean, is there sort of a? I know there's no international cabal. We've established that already, but is there usually like about a generational resting period, 20 years, when a color is going to go out of fashion before it's eligible to come back in again?
No, there really isn't a standard resting period because today we find that there are we're so much more aware of what is happening with color all over the world. And you happen to mention rust, and even though it is a color that's, you know, followed the vagaries of fashion in and out, we know that it was very big in the 70s because earth tones were really in. It relaxed a bit in the 80s because in the 80s we had kind of a whoopee-doo thing happening economically from the mid to the end of the 80s. We had a little drop in the 90s, which the beginning of the 90s, which brought grunge and long skirts and dark colors. So again, we follow the vagaries of fashion, but I will take issue with you just a bit as far as Rust is concerned. Rust has stayed in the picture. We may, you know, give it a different name. We may call it terracotta or something like that. But it has stayed in the picture longer because of this whole, you know, I said earth tone, and the whole involvement that we have now with the preservation of the earth, and how those colors really have not gone out as quickly as they had before. They are staying around, and as long as there's going to be this renewed interest, I think you're going to get some variation of that rust tone. It's become a classic.
Well, okay, I guess I'm not the only person who likes it then. That's good to know. The I have to wonder, though, if certain uses of color are in reaction to others. If for example, if you have a period of years when you have poison green being really big, if then muted tones are going to be the popular ones in the years that follow that.
Well, I think there is some of that because, again, designers know that you can only offer the same colors for so long. And then people do get tired of them, or they already have it in the closet. Why would they replace it with anything new? So the time will come to go to something that is quite the opposite. And you will find that, you know, kind of skipping across the color wheel. If you've done a lot of blues and greens, then you go across to the warm colors on the opposite side. I can't say that every designer thinks that way, you know, because they're influenced by various things. But for a large part, yes, it's true that once you have a color that's been out there and a color family that's been out there for a while, you will often see someone will come forth, or maybe several designers will come forth with the same idea at the same time. We need something warm. We've had a lot of coolness in the last few years.
We have a call here from Charles in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Leatrice Eisman from Pantone. Her book is Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color and Design. Hi, Charles.
Oh, hello. It might be a little off base, but I've heard it said that certain colors of cars will attract more attention from law enforcement. Say if you have a flashy red sports car, you're more likely to get a ticket. Is this true?
I get that question often for obvious reasons. Well, we did some research on it. We checked with insurance companies and police departments because we like to do our homework. We just don't, you know, arbitrarily come up with an answer. And we have found, in fact, that yes, the red in particular will attract more attention, but it has to be a warm red. It seems that the warm reds cause more attention than the cool reds do. So that's the color you have to be a little cautious of. But do know that red cars have a tendency at twilight to go brown. So you're going to be in less trouble after twilight, but during the day I'd be a little cautious if you're driving a car that has a strong yellow red tone to it.
All right. Well, as you were talking about light, here's a question from Jim in Grants Pass. I think about that very thing. Welcome, Jim, with Leatrice Eisman.
Yes, one of the things that I think is missing in a lot of teaching and things is the old saying, his ideas were presented in a different light and accepted. That's not a fallacy. I mean, light, the brain, color is an idea. Just like, is it presented in natural light, artificial light, morning light, evening light, you know, it makes so much difference. And quick example, art, clothing, stocking a used car lot, placing different things together can, you know, just bring the eye to it. Or I've helped hang an art show, and I told them to change some stuff because it wasn't the pictures that were conflicting, it was the frames. Only they could see is these goofy frames that were conflicting colors, and they never even noticed the pictures.
Okay, gets back to what Lee was saying before. Thanks for that, Jim, about you want to make sure that colors look good together, too.
Yes, absolutely, and light definitely plays a part in it, and that's why when people ask about, you know, painting the color of the house, of the interior, we are always very quick to advise them to look at it in every light. Look at that color in every light that you're going to be seeing it in, because it will change. And we all know that, and it's one of the frustrations that people have, that the color does seem to have this changeable appearance. But you can overcome that simply by making sure that you paint a nice big white board in that color, and you can move it around at various times of the day and really make sure that you're going to like that color, that you're going to be able to live with that color depending on the light that's landing on it.
So, Lee, I want to finish up talking about the Pantone picking a color of the year. What is the color of the year a reaction to what everybody's using, or is it a forecasting tool?
Well, it is a little bit of both. We watch what is happening in the world of color. When I say we watch, those of us at Pantone who are responsible for doing this are travelers. You know, I travel a lot during the year, so do my colleagues. And we are watching the worldwide movement in color. And what you start to see is that there is a certain family of color, perhaps, or a particular color that is gaining some ascendancy, some momentum. We are very cautious to look at that from the standpoint of what other influences are showing that. It could be a new film that's coming out perhaps next year where that color is going to play a part. Again, we have to do our homework on that. It could be a traveling art collection where an artist is gaining attention again and his or her favorite color was in a particular family. A lot of people will be seeing that color. That's something we should be paying attention to. We also look at the psychological effect of color. What is that color saying? Is it something that is going to build people up, make them feel better? We certainly don't want to choose a color that's going to depress everyone. The color for this year, Radiant Orchid, we made a very conscious decision to choose a color which is known for its creativity. It comes from the purple family, and we are living in a very innovative, creative time period. There's no question of that. And so we felt it was a color family that would really capture everyone's attention, and it certainly has in the year that's gone by. We have seen many people adapting that color, using it as a, even if it's an accessory, a scarf, a tie, you know, using it in some way that acknowledges, yes, this is kind of a breath of fresh air, this is something new, they understand the symbolism of it, and they talk about it. It's amazing to me what a topic of conversation it becomes when I tell people what I do, and it turns to the color of the year. They're fascinated by it.
Absolutely. Well, the color again this year, Radiant Orchid, and you heard it from one of the queens of the color world, Leatrice Eisman, is a color specialist and forecaster for Pantone, the executive director of the Pantone Color Institute, head of the Eisman Center for Color Information and Training, and the co-author with E.P. Cutler of Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design, a very sumptuous book and a lot of fun to leaf through. Thanks so much for joining us today, Lee.
You're very welcome.
Pleasure to have you.